I'm Christopher Leiden, and this is Open Source with Richard Powers in a little room in the Boston Athenaeum on the top of Beacon Hill, 10 and a half Beacon Street, overlooking the old granary burying ground, after a marvelous reading and talk out of this new book, Or Fail, which is a novel about everything. It's a novel about this moment, but it's also a wonderful inquiry about music, the nature of it, tonality, which is to say the eight-note scale as a sort of center of gravity of traditional music, and the 20th century's kind of trashing of it and remaking of the whole idea. What's the music behind the music is really the thread in the book, but it's also a story about a 71-year-old retired college professor in a Pennsylvania college town who's cooking up DNA and gets caught in the ringer of Homeland Security. It's a kind of retrospective on his life, his wife, his daughter, but also on the history of 20th century music. I'd love to begin just sort of where your talk left off. What I was thinking of was, where's jazz in the mind of this man, Peter Else?
I think there was a conscious decision on my part at the three-quarter point in the composition of the book, realizing that, yes, jazz could have held some answers for Peter's quest, but it would have greatly expanded his journey, maybe beyond the carrying capacity of the story. So I am a fan via classical, and a lot of the first jazz to open to me, you know, were those people who were playing off that idiom in interesting ways. But, you know, there are great stories. I mean, you probably know this story about Parker playing in New York and looking out into the audience and seeing Stravinsky. And all of a sudden, seamlessly, in the middle of a solo, quoting from Rite of Spring, you know, without missing a beat, and, you know, Stravinsky just falling over backwards in his chair. So jazz is closer to the classical idiom than the pop idiom, as far as I'm concerned. In the real division in music, I think, is not highbrow, lowbrow. It's not socioeconomic, because that gets so turned on its head in different countries and different places and different times. The real division, it seems to me, is music that appeals instantly through sonority and a reduction in complexity, and using repetition as a way of creating the propulsion and the hook and the forward motion, versus music that's developmental and needs to change in the way that narrative changes, and that requires memory to know how far that theme is traveling and to be able to hear the keys change and, you know, to move farther or closer to home, to see two melodies taken apart and genetically, you know, spliced together. Cognitively, you're using different kinds of brain activities to engage that sort of music. My guy, Peter Else, happens to be intoxicated with pattern and changing pattern. And so music that relies on that high degree of redundancy is just, it's only interesting for a minute to him, you know, and before he's mastered the genetic algorithm that's driving that melody. And I think there is, in all music and in all art, a kind of inverted V, if you will, of pleasure, that not everything opens to you instantly. Yeah. Some things do. I mean, a beautiful tune that you turn on in the car on a summer's day driving down Lakeshore Drive that has the perfect hook, you can fall in love with instantly. And you can be singing along on the first chorus before it's over. The question is, if you have that rapid entry into something and you go up that inverted V of pleasure, increased familiarity will tend to take you over the crest and down toward over-familiarity faster because of, you know, reduced capacity for surprise.
The great pleasure in listening to music over and over again is that it keeps unfolding anew. I love that line. I'm not sure whose it is. The line in your book is, I've been hearing that tune for 60 years. Musical taste changes so little. The sound of late childhood plays at our funerals. But I have that experience listening to Errol Garner or Duke Ellington. I mean, I've been listening to it for damn near 60 years, and it sounds better and better, more deeply mysterious, particularly the improvised sort of happening in the moment music. And you hear so many things going on every single time, hundreds and hundreds of times.
That's true. And I think that music that resists the fading of overfamiliarity is the stuff that we take with us throughout our entire lives. What gives it that quality? I think it has to have some unique combination of expectation and surprise, of predictability and yes. complete, you know, violation of expectation, in order to keep us coming back. There has to be some degree of narrative twist yeah. in the way that the stuff develops. The music you mentioned is complex music. The beloved tune that you hear on the radio and fall in love with before it's over is probably not one that you'll be able to hear new things in forever. You can set it aside, let time pass, and get out of that attenuation or habituation that you fell into from overexposure, and hear it again and be transported back in. I mean, music has that unique ability to be time-stamped onto your life so that you have that sort of Proustian visceral recreation of where you were when you heard it. But in terms of that experience that you're describing where it keeps opening and you say, my God, I didn't know that was in there. That's the kind of music that Els is after.
Richard Powers, let me just say, it's a joy to be in the spell of your work and Orfeo and this character, Peter Els, the DNA of music or something even more abstract. All he wants before he dies, you write, is to break free of time and to hear the future. He's looking for a shortcut to the sublime, something in music beyond taste, built into the evolved brain. I laugh because aren't we all, in a sense, looking for it? None is quite as articulately as you. But one of my questions reading this book was, what is it about novelists and music? You mentioned Proust. He has that marvelous moment in a chamber concert where Marcel is listening and thinking, what if we had evolved differently, not in a linear verbal mode, but that music had become the communion of souls, the communication of souls. But I'm also thinking Thomas Mann, Dr. Faustus, but then lately, Teju Cole, that novel Open City, wonderful book, but he's absorbed with Mahler 9, as you are. And then most recently, Nick Baker, who we think of as a kind of comic contemporary novelist, but he's become a songwriter. And he's thinking, he's remembering his days as a bassoonist. He knows a lot about music. And he's thinking all these Peter Els thoughts about what the hell is this all about? And how does it work organically, spiritually, invisibly? Why do novelists come to land on music as the location of so much mystery? And maybe the answer.
Yeah, the list is very long and the obsession is tenacious. I think we're jealous. There's a way in which the appeal of music, in sidestepping everything semantic and just reaching into your rib cage and, you know, massaging your heart, is just, I mean, it's such a matter of envy for novelists who have to mediate everything with words that mean things, and, you know, that the specificity of which and the real world referent of which can often get in the way of the sublime and that sense of communicating directly to the body. You know, little babies at the age of 6 weeks will start to bob deliriously, joyfully to music. And it's tough to be a novelist and look at that and not say, I want, you know, that's how I want to move somebody. The trade-off, of course, is the lack of real-world referent in music, except in fairly crude programmatic music, also means that it can never appeal to the complicated narrative urge in the same way that literal stories can appeal. So my composer friends will often say, but when I really want to take a journey, I wish I could do the kinds of things that you writers do and create complex interactions between multiple groups of people. Maybe that's why, in a sense, film has become the dominant medium of our time, because they get to have their cake and eat it too. They get to tell the literal story of human beings with different value systems crashing up against each other and colliding and trying to make good in a world that wants to thwart them, while at the same time they can have that soundtrack. that goes right into you, and in the absence of action or word or even gesture, just one little flicker of muscle in the cheek and the right sonority, the right expanse of sound, and suddenly everybody in the theater is in another world. Mm. So as a writer, the solution to that intense envy of music is every 10 years or so to write about it, to take, you know, musicians and the making of music as your subject matter. But there are other things that you can do as well. You can use musical form to shape a novel.
Doing talk radio over the years, it just came to seem to me that when people talk about music, they're really talking about their religious life one step removed or abstracted. I'll never forget a woman who called. We were talking about Brahms, which we tended to do, but she called in and talked about hearing the Brahms piano quintet as a child, and she said, "Christopher, it was the first time I fell in love." And remembering it with huge emotion and sort of goosebump power, which is part of the envy thing too, I think.
Well, it is a total mystery why that happens to us. I'm teaching a course now at Stanford on evolutionary psychology and narrative. And actually, I think you can make a very strong case, although you can't run any double-blind experiments. It seems fairly clear why being able to tell and decode and fall under the spell of stories would have adaptive survival benefits. It's not at all clear to me why, you know, hearing simple little sequences of pitch modulation, you know, changes, should be able to do anything at all to me. There are lots of theories, but none, to my mind, really is strong enough to say why we can be undone, as you say, in a religious way, in a spiritual way, by vibrations of air. To some extent, it depends on a kind of literacy. You can feel the surface beauty of Brahms, just the ravishing quality of that sound. But in order to know what's happening, and to order to be really reduced, I think you do need some grounding in the language of tonality, in the way that expectations are built, in the way, you know, that he's creating tendencies, which he then draws out and delays in these agonizing, patient, sensuous and seductive detours, and then delivers home when we least expect it. Those kinds of things require a certain degree of literacy, but that literacy requires time and effort and lots of exposure when you're young. If you don't have that, it's tough to feel that same sense of thrill.
But he's also telling a story, right? I mean, this is a narrative structure, creating an expectation and delivering on it. I mean, I love the notion that people take very seriously about Mozart, that there's nothing in his keyboard music, in his quartets, or anything that isn't a love story, that isn't some sort of conversation between a tenor voice and a soprano, or a man and a woman, or something. They're as operatic as his operas.
He was the dramatic composer without peer, even in the instrumental music. It's no surprise that he gravitated so strongly to opera as a medium. But again, to feel that as a story, to hear those melodies as characters that are colliding and being changed by other characters inside the drama, we need memory, we need literacy in harmonic expectation. I mean, to some extent, we take in music with our mother's milk, right?
We're,
it's all over. And these estimates of how much music an infant hears in a given day, it's astonishing, you know, how much you'll take in through various media in the course of a day. But again, there is the appeal of sonority and surface and melody and rhythm, right? The immediacy of rhythm. But to hear complex changes in harmony, for instance, requires a kind of key. It requires knowing the rules of the game.
I didn't expect to mention this, but go home and listen to Brahms's Opus 5, Third Piano Sonata, the slow movement. Once you think about it, it's unmistakably a tryst on a little island at dusk. And there's a male voice and there's a female voice. I think there are, my own opinion is that there are four climaxes in the piece in every sense. And Claudio Arrau called it the most nearly X-rated piece in the repertoire. But it is a narrative, and I don't know that you'd have to hear it that way. But once you think about it, once your dirty little mind thinks about it that way, there's nothing else going on.
And there's an interesting thing about Brahms, too, and literacy, and maybe the downside of literacy. I mean, you know what his reputation was in his lifetime, as a reactionary throwback to classicism, as somebody who wouldn't allow passion into his music, but was too much of a formalist, was too obsessed with sonata allegro form, and too much of an architect. And when we listen to him now, how could anyone have heard that music that way? And this is interesting for a novelist like myself, too, to realize how expectation plays such a role in cueing and priming and anchoring what a person's going to be able to hear in any kind of work.
I wanted to be bold and just ask you to play the old BBC game, Desert Island Discs, music you would take to your desert island if you weren't coming back. Maximum five pieces, but you do that in effect in this book. You go through things starting with the Appalachian Spring, Copland in this country in the mid-50s, but also Mahler. We can play that music in the studio and let you talk over it, because each one of those pieces seems to me is obviously a jumping off point for all the questions that Peter Eltz is chasing. Where do you want to start?
The great pleasure of writing this book and spending 5 years creating this 70-year-old life made up of 110 years of Western concert music tradition was being able to indulge listening as a part of the process. Ordinarily, you know, the writer who wants to work in the long form, you know, has to be on guard against all diversions and all little tricks to delay the writing of the next segment. And in ordinary cases, my love for music and my desire to be sustained by it would lead me into days of lots of time spent in beautiful backwaters. You know, when writing this book, I thought, no, that's not the diversion. That's the actual work. That's the research necessary to make the thing. So the love affair here is with transgressive music, a century and more of music that was somehow hungry to break the rules of the moment, to go beyond good taste or form or well-behaved sequences, and to create something that the ear didn't know how to hear yet. For me, that historical act of going back and hearing these war horses, pieces that are now completely absorbed into the canon or one canon or another, and to hear them again as pieces capable of causing great distress and anxiety and disturbing the safety of their listeners. You know, the first example in the book, and probably the oldest that fulfills that role of setting us off on this avant-garde tradition, was the Mahler Kindertotenlieder. So 1903, roughly, I mean, he writes the five songs. There's a little gap. He starts them in 1 year and finishes them a couple years later. But right at the beginning of the 20th century, when so much else is happening to throw Europe and the whole world into revolution, but these late days of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the great moment of post-romanticism, it's unclear how to push the envelope forward. Music's been struggling against itself since the early 19th century with Beethoven's desire to push outwards and to make it new and to find an idiom capable of leaving the earth in some ways. And there is a kind of decadent quality to some of this post-romantic music at the end of the century. And you can hear a little bit in the texture of Mahler. Something that comes down from Wagner and isn't, in a sense, much changed. But in these songs, I think, you begin to hear the complete disintegration of tonality. He's gone back and taking these sometimes maudlin, sometimes obsessive, always grief-stricken poems of Friedrich Rückert on the deaths of his own children. The guy wrote hundreds of poems about his two children that died of scarlet fever. And Mahler, for whatever reason, you know, whatever fascination with this horrific topic decides to set a song cycle to them. And you can hear, you know, from that first song in the cycle, a kind of tension between the beautiful, mournful, sorrow-laden melody and this swelling impatience and agony and grief-stricken instrumental accompaniment. You can hear the careful language of tonal music really start to jump over the cliff.
Meaning what? And why does it fascinate Peter Eltz so?
It fascinates Eltz because here's a piece of music that has one foot in the familiar, the continuous, the beautiful, the sensuous, the ravishing, but is being driven forward into an agony that's willing to take down its own building blocks with it, to tear down the building around its own ears. And sure enough, I mean, within a few years, the full revolution is launched, and you know, you've followed down into Schoenberg and the Second Viennese School, a complete rejection of this language, a repudiation of that language as nostalgic or reactionary. Interestingly, Schoenberg made his students look to Mahler as the place where that revolution really started.
Messiaen, that's a marvelous sequence in the book about Oliver Messiaen writing the quartet for the end of time in a Nazi camp and performing it. Tell us that story.
It is one of the most dramatic stories of 20th century concert music. Messiaen, I mean, you can't get a more otherworldly figure to begin with. He could barely see. He was a synesthete. He was a deeply spiritual person. He was not politically savvy. He really wasn't equipped to live in the world of social reality. Picked up very soon in the war after the German invasion of France and sent to this prisoner of war camp in Silesia. And there in the camp met three other musicians of great skill, a violinist, a cellist, and a clarinetist. They discovered that they could marshal between them four very beaten-up instruments, and Messiaen recreated from memory a piece that he had written prior to his imprisonment and expanded that into this immense piece for an unusual ensemble. And he was taken under the wing of the commandant of the camp, who somehow in the chaos of the war managed to find a staff paper for him to write and put him into a room and had armed guard keep watch over the room in order to protect the solitude necessary to create. Why? I don't know why. Because Germans love music. And this guy wanted to hear the intense imagination of what this great creative maker who was his enemy might be capable of making. And so these men practice this piece that is immensely technically difficult. And, you know, they're doing this in the depths of winter, in unheated barracks. You know, the story is that the cello had three strings and they picked it up in a flea market for a handful of marks, and the piano's keys would go down very nicely, but they didn't always come back up. You know, so under the most incredibly difficult circumstances and without any idea of compromise, Messiaen creates this astonishing set of textures for this group and performs it on a cold night in January, you know, again with the Germans in the front row, the prisoners of war who are coming from all walks of life, some of whom had never been to any concert, you know, let alone one of the most unrelenting avant-garde music. Thank you. Messiaen himself wrote years later that throughout his entire long career and an incredibly prolific outpouring of music and great celebration internationally, that he was never listened to with such attention as he was on that night.
But it's also a quartet to the end of time. I think Messiaen, you quote in effect saying that the birds and birdsong are the opposite of time. This is an essay about time, very much in the sort of Proustian mystery. Chase that one.
Well, he was taken at the time with revelation, and he was, as a mystic and a religious mystic, attempting to find a musical vocabulary that would somehow invoke what happens after time ends. But of course, it's the title in part and the story in part which gave this music enough mystery for people who might otherwise be turned away by the idiom to realize that there was mystery at work here and to give it that extra listening or multiple listenings necessary to come to terms with the language. I needed the piece in this story for many reasons. I mean, it's composed the year of my composer's birth, and in a sense, this is the music that he would have grown up with and be formed by. But I also needed it because music, again, to go back to that idea of music as the unmediated language without meaning except what it does to your body, music has that unique ability to break the bonds of time and to give us this momentary sense of, in a line of Richard Wilbur, I think, of being constantly spinning unspun. You know?
Whose line is it in your book that said, music doesn't mean things, it is things?
Yeah, that's Peter Rell's wrestling with this mystery of needing something, needing some formal or technical or linguistic understanding of how these effects are made, but also wanting to transcend it and simply create something that cannot be paraphrased, that simply it taps directly into the central nervous system and just moves us. Yeah.
Richard Powers, riff as you have been doing, if you will, on the American piece that figures so importantly in this book. Your guy, Peter Els, at the age of 7 or 8, is learning the clarinet, and he's transfixed by Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring, which everybody knows and loves. What's the hook there?
So Appalachian Spring, if I'm remembering right, was 1943. Or there were the two versions. I guess it was originally the ballet for 13 instruments, and then because it was so instantly a hit, he knew on which side his bread was buttered, and he created an orchestral version of that, which has been, you know, in the repertoire, you know, ever since. And, you know, is if a person today, you know, with no exposure to American concert music of the 20th century, hears only one piece of concert music, it would be that, I think. That has to be right up there. But in any case, it's a music of great beauty, and it's a music of simplicity and melody, and it's also a nostalgic music. It's a music that treats in Americana, if you will. It's, you know, it culminates, of course, in the great Shaker tune Simple Gifts, and in a sense, from the beginning, he's setting up a harmonic palette that's going to provide the foundation through this long journey and sets of variations to culminate in counterpoint with that hymn tune. Why I need this for Peter Els as a young man, as a a kid, is it's a kind of watershed. You know, it's a spring that's about to become a much more long, hot summer, if you will. That music, concert music in this country is going to elect to take a very different turn and look toward the European avant-garde for its next impulse, and the unrelenting, uncompromising music that is already establishing itself in the 50s and is going to really reign supreme throughout high musical cultures and certainly academic musical cultures in the next decade, is going to look upon this music as something that needs to die and needs to be done away with in whatever way possible. And it's this tension, it's the tension between beauty and rigor, between looking backwards and looking forwards, that's going to constitute the central drama in Else's personal life.
So many other things happen in this novel, and we won't get to all of them, but Peter Else's pursuit of the musical mystery and of other chemical mysteries and DNA mysteries plunge him into this bizarre confrontation with Homeland Security. It is a kind of Armageddon, this kind of incredible punishment that is visited on him. What is that story in your own head? What are we going through in this revelation that almost everything Peter Else has done, every phone call, every connection, every note practically, every bit of DNA he's cooked up is on the record and is going to get him in trouble, the deepest imaginable sort of trouble?
Well, let me take one big step back and see if I can take a running start at this. You know, Duke Ellington said, when art ceases to be dangerous, you don't want it. And we know that to some extent that's a metaphor. And when we say that such and such an artist or a performer is taking risks, it's a little bit hyperbolic, right? I mean, they're not taking risks in the way that, somebody who's just been, posted to Afghanistan is taking a risk. But he's talking about a need to incorporate the disturbing into art and to reawaken attention and the ability to feel deeply by subverting expectation and making listening a little bit less safe than it might otherwise be and less familiar. And Else takes that seriously as he begins his quest for a music that the ear can't quite hear yet. And the need for an art that that complicates or threatens or upends the listener is something that he's willing to gamble with, to the extent that he pays the price that most avant-garde composers pay, where they end up writing music that can be terribly, terribly thrilling, but to a very, very small and exclusive coterie. Most of the concerts of his music throughout his life end up in a state that would be very familiar to other artists in this tradition, namely more people up on stage than in the audience. But in his attempt to push this question of dangerous art, by the end of his life, he's willing to literalize that danger and to create an art that perhaps he doesn't know initially is going to scare a nation, but has that capacity to do to a nation that is looking looking for an illusory safety, seeing danger under every bed, and it's this final reification in a way of this impulse to make something that takes away your security that runs him into literal trouble. So the fear of culture that constitutes his entire life ends up colliding with the culture of fear that we've created and perpetuated in the last 11, 12 years.
But that's a huge change, and I wanted you to spell out just what the transformation is. I mean, empty concert halls is the familiar punishment for writing avant-garde music, but the hammer comes down on him in a in a way that's almost incredible, except it's very believable. The Homeland Security guys are in his house.
Yep. As they have been in other people's houses whose motives may not even be as ambiguous as Peter Elson. I based the book in part on the 2004 story of Steve Kurtz, the bio artist and conceptual artist who was with SUNY Buffalo and had exhibited bio art in museums internationally. When the police found equipment in his house, it should have been a matter of just a couple of hours before he was able to exonerate himself and show that all this stuff was necessary preparation for an upcoming exhibition. In fact, it was 4 years before he was entirely cleared of all charges.
I mean, remind us, what might the charges have been?
Well, I mean, initially it was the suspicion was that he was using biological materials to plan a terrorist assault. This was patent nonsense, and he very quickly demonstrated that this wasn't the case. They then became interested in the means by which he acquired this material. And whether or not that was legally done. And in fact, there are precious few laws about the propagation and distribution of this material. And do-it-yourself biology is actually widely practiced in this country by hundreds, if not thousands, of people. But ultimately, the only charge that they had any reasonable chance of making stick was mail order fraud, and that was the last one that they dropped 4 years down the road, presumably in an attempt to save face. I can't imagine that they were doing this to teach any lessons to other people, but I think that's the problem with this illusory and relentless pursuit of safety. It becomes potentially a danger beyond the one that it's protecting us from.
Something's happening out there in the changing the rules on the NSA, the maybe heroic role for Edward Snowden. Chelsea Manning is still in prison for the next 35 years, but what's the direction of things?
Well, you don't even have to make a decision about what you think of Snowden, what kind of guy he is, how he's handled this, what his personal motives are. I think the question is, would you rather live in a country where all this was happening anyway and you didn't know about it, or one where it's out in the public sphere and we can now talk about it and start to discuss what kind of country we want to live in and what safeguards we're willing to pay the price for? But it needs to be a matter of public discussion. And the problem with what he has disclosed, and we have not yet seen the full extent of the disclosures, apparently there's a tremendous amount of material that hasn't been gone through and transcribed and released yet. But until he did what he did, and until we realized the full extent of the security state's efforts against non-suspects or not yet suspects, we were living in the belief that democracy was capable of creating the public discourse necessary to answer the questions that were in our best interest, but until it became a matter of public knowledge, that just was not the case.
Richard Powers, I don't think I've admired you enough in this conversation for erudition and scholarship and imagination and lyricism. I don't know that you have a rival out there in American fiction. So I got to get that on the record. But here we are in the Athenaeum, might as well be the 18th century, overlooking the old granary burying ground. Mother Goose is buried out there, all that sort of thing. But I'm fascinated to hear that you had your own Boston period only 30 years ago. I'd love your riff on sort of what's changed, what's new, what's different, what's not, what's threatening, what's familiar, what's fun.
Well, yes, this town has tremendous resonance for me. It's where I started my literary career. I went to school thinking I would be a physicist. I took a wrong turn. I ended up becoming obsessed with literature very early on in my literary reading. At that time, I fell under the spell of Emerson and Thoreau and what was happening in New England throughout the 19th century. And I wanted to come to Boston for that reason and just walk those streets and see those buildings. And I arrived in my early 20s without any clue as to how I was going to make a living. I had taught myself how to program, so that was the most likely source of a steady income. Got a place in the Fens, and the Athenaeum was a place that I had paid more than one pilgrimage to, and just that the sense of being inside the building and knowing the figures who were associated with this place was an intense aura for me. And it was, as you alluded to, my seeing a photograph at the MFA, the first ever American retrospective exhibition of the German photographer August Sander, that was the direct inspiration for my first novel, and led me on a three-decade unpredictable, long and winding road that...
Remind us of that photograph, the one.
This is a triple portrait. It's three young men in their... Sunday finest suits with canes and hats, walking down a muddy road, and the title of the photograph is "Young Vestervald Farmers on Their Way to a Dance, 1914." And when I saw this in the exhibition in the MFA, you can't see that image, that naive, the self inventing but somewhat ingenuous pose of these guys looking out at the photographer, performing themselves, and then look down and read that caption and see that year, without realizing that they were not on the way to the dance that they thought they were on their way to. Mm-hmm. And in fact, just down this little muddy road in spring was World War I and the end of the Europe that they were born into, and the beginning of the catastrophe of the 20th century, whose repercussions we're still living with. I then left Boston and worked in the Midwest for a long, long time. The next time that I came back to Boston was in the year 2008, when I was working on a novel about genetics, and I got the extraordinary invitation to come out at the initiative of GQ magazine to come out and become the ninth person on Earth to have my full genome sequenced. This was when direct-to-client genomics looked like a coming thing, and there was a company here that was doing these. At the time, they were charging $350,000 for a full genome. GQ worked a deal with them to get a cut rate, down and dirty sequence as a kind of promotion, and I was going to write the story. And they wanted, very specifically, they did not want a scientist to undergo this. They wanted a novelist. They wanted to talk about what the personal ramifications of genomic knowledge would be. And so I was coming back to this place. In a sense, the promise was that I would look into my genome and I would see my ancestry and I would see my family history and all this, this biological legacy. But what was amazing to me is coming back to this town and seeing the much more immediate and personal legacy of this place where I had begun as a writer and was now seeing with the eyes of a man in middle age. You know.
So generalize, broad brush on what's changed in 30 years. It was yesterday. That was second term of Reagan.
Well, and for me, that uncanny sense of looking through the wrong end of the telescope. It wasn't all that long ago, and yet it is very difficult to connect that world to this world. And the primary difference, of course, is the complete transformation of space and time at the hands of the digital. And we have so normalized that, you know, it takes deliberate effort to realize that my consciousness in 1985 is completely unreachable to me now because of everything that I've internalized about what these incredible prosthetics have done to us and can do for us. It's a mixed legacy, of course. I now have access to all the music ever written, and I've got this in my pocket right now, and you can name whatever you'd like to hear, and we could listen to it right now. The downside, of course, is that we either won't do that, or we will do so for 2 or 3 minutes before our attention is distracted and we begin to look for something else, or a notification comes in telling us that something much more exciting is happening somewhere else. So yeah, that's an immense story. I can't do justice to it in a soundbite, but it's important to remember that in a way comparable to any revolution in the human story, in human consciousness wrought by technology, since the beginning, with the possible exception of maybe writing, I think we have lived through something that's changed what it means to be human.
Yeah, and we wonder if E.M. Forster would say, "Only disconnect," right?
Well, you know, it's funny because Forster has that great story, that early 20th century, around the time that Mahler was writing The Kindertotenlieder, called The Machine Stops. Do you remember this one?
No.
Yeah, you should look it up. I can't remember it exactly, but it has something to do with, you know, we're all living in cubicles and we're all being mediated. You know, it's like he's got this vision of the online world already. And the guy wants to see his mother. He wants to meet the woman out of whose loins he sprang. And this is considered the most unnatural thing that a person could want. I hope I'm paraphrasing this in a way that bears some resemblance to actually happens.
We'll check. Go ahead.
Yeah. But in any case, just this idea that, at this moment, of modernism, somebody is already seeing just where the ability to manipulate time and space and to mediate our experience through machines could possibly lead us. And of course, that, we would read the story and laugh, but in fact, we have, to some extent, become the thing that that Forster most fears.
Richard Powers, such a pleasure to read you, and the frosting on the cake to hear you. This has been a great treat. Thank you. Thank you for all your work, and thank you for this conversation.
My word, thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Richard Powers' new novel is called Orfeo. Mary McGrath produced this conversation. Carly Nix recorded and edited it. Lydia Moland inspired us to do it. It isn't over, as we say, until listeners, that's you, add a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Project.